There's a new situation comedy premiering this week, and it's in a setting familiar to all of us listening to Radio Free Konyaspyty, a public radio station. The TV series called FM was co-created by my guest Alan Burns, who's worked with MTM Productions ever since 1970, when he and James Brooks created The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Burns went on to co-produce the spin-offs, Rhoda and Lou Grant. These shows presented new kinds of characters on television that reflected the changing times. Mary was a single working woman in her 30s. Rhoda divorced her husband in the fourth season of her show. And Lou Grant drew material from many social issues, including homelessness and labor strikes. Lou Grant was canceled in 1982 after the star, Ed Asner, publicly supported humanitarian aid for the people of El Salvador. Burns' new show, FM, airs this Thursday on NBC. It stars Robert Hayes as the program director of a listener-supported public radio station in Washington, D.C. In the first segment, we meet some of the characters, such as the mellifluous classical music announcer, who doubles as the host of the reggae show.
This is WGEO-FM, National Public Radio for Georgetown and the greater Washington area, where weekday nights at 8, you can hear me, Quentin Lamoureux, and the Classics Shelf. But now...
I'm already regularis. This is the mighty Dr. Cure. We're going to spend some wicked ones for you today. So for the next 2 hours, kick back in your hammock and don't worry, be happy.
Thank you very much for coming and being on Fresh Air today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The show was set in a public radio station, and a lot of the Mary Tyler Moore productions, the MTM productions, such as the show in Minneapolis set at WJM and in Cincinnati WKRP, and Lou Grant at a newspaper, and now this one at WGEO, an NPR station in Washington, D.C., are set at kind of marginal operations in the broadcasting or the newspaper world. What was it about public radio that attracted you as a setting for this comedy?
I'm tempted to say public radio is marginal, but I don't think that's true.
It must be mainstream enough to put it on TV.
Well, I think NBC has their questions about how mainstream public radio is. I know that when we broached the subject to Brandon Tartikoff, who is the celebrated president of NBC, he was... a little skeptical, I think, as to whether people who watch TV listen to NPR and vice versa. And I think we tried to convince him that there is a great deal of comedy in this, that perhaps we can educate each other a little bit about NPR, about television, and vice versa. That there are certainly there's a huge television audience that probably doesn't watch NPR that might be attracted to it as a result of, I hope, as a result of watching this program. People who just honestly don't know it's even there and should. I know that Dan and I, Dan Wilcox, when we came up with this idea, it was simply because... in our own car radios, we realized that when we weren't listening to tapes, what we listened to was the local NPR affiliate here in Los Angeles, which is KCRW.
Did you go down to the station and observe the operations?
Yeah, we spent a great deal of time. I've been listening, I think, to KCRW for 10 years probably, and had some vague notion that it broadcast out of a basement somewhere on the university campus here. And which is true. It comes from Santa Monica College. It's in the basement of the cafeteria building. When Dan and I arrived to visit there for the first time, we were given a map and detailed instructions on how to find it, and it still took us 20 minutes. But when we got down there into the bowels of this building, here is this really... first-class radio station with a lot of the state-of-the-art equipment. We were just amazed that it's as modern and as good a facility as it is. But what struck us most and why we thought we were really onto something when we visited there was the sort of passion that the people who work there have for what they're doing. Certainly nobody who works in public radio does it for the money, so you must do it for another reason. And I think passion is a very precious commodity. When you're doing drama or comedy, if the people that you're writing about are passionate about what they do, I think that comes across.
The audiences for a lot of the MTM production shows, which have included Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere, Lou Grant, the Bob Newhart Show, and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, have always drawn an educated and well-to-do audience, which has been often different from the mass audience to meet the needs of mass market advertisers. And so some of these shows have always run into ratings difficulties, have been canceled and so forth. Certainly that's a characteristic of being educated that public radio stations and their audiences share with some of the viewers of these MTM productions. How did you make an argument with the networks in this time of declining television audience that setting it at a public radio station would work?
Well, I think we simply had to convince them it was going to have an audience appeal, that it was going to be funny. Curiously enough, they did not ask us to lowbrow it at any point or make it broader or anything like that. They were interested in the same values we were, which surprised us a bit. I argue with you a little bit that the MTM shows were too intellectual for the masses, so to speak, because certainly the Mary Tyler Moore Show, with which I was associated for 7 years, had a very large audience. Lou Grant, for all its topicality, was a top 10 show a good deal of the time that it was on the air.
Well, shows, for instance, like Hill Street Blues were saved by great audience pressure. The shows were to be canceled because they weren't getting the ratings.
I think Hill Street Blues was saved by the fact that in its first year it won about 9 Emmys, which had an effect on the network, and they were able to parlay that into publicity, which got them a larger audience. They really stayed with that show for a long time when it was very marginal. They, meaning NBC, stayed with it for a good long time. I'm not afraid of being too smart for the television audience. I think the audience is hungry for things that are smarter than the networks are willing to give them credit for. For example, there are a couple of shows right now that are doing rather well that I don't think are aiming low. One of them is Wonder Years. Another is Murphy Brown. And the audience that you speak of, by the way, that smart, affluent audience, is after all who the advertiser is going after.
One of the characteristics of shows that you've written and co-created and produced has been the establishment of a strong woman character, Mary Tyler Moore's character, the women characters that have reflected, social change and attitudes. Has this been something that you have directly sought to do, or just something that's evolved out of, say, that you were writing for Mary Tyler Moore?
No, when Jim Brooks and I, who was my co-creator and co-producer on that show and a couple of spinoffs from it, Rhoda and Lou Grant. Jim and I created the Mary Show. We didn't have any particular ideas at that moment about feminism. We sort of got lucky with that. We rode the crest of feminism was just beginning to happen in this country, and we hired a lot of women writers early on, because they were good writers, not because they were women, but because there were some women that we knew that we wanted to have associated with the show, who were very sensitized about what was going on, and they kind of, in a way, led us into it, and we didn't resist. It seemed like something that was happening.
One of your productions was about a character named Lou Grant, newspaper editor, and it was portrayed by Ed Asner, who was outspoken on topics, political topics, in the course of the show, but also as an individual, politically active. And after a press conference announcing that he was sending medical aid to victims of the El Salvador junta, there was a great campaign and hue and cry to either get rid of him personally or sink the show. And there was a pressure, and it worked. Had you ever seen anything like this in your time in television or anything since?
I hadn't seen anything like it before. It was very frightening, actually, what happened to Ed. I don't know that it was very well publicized, but there were death threats against Ed. We had armed guards on our soundstage for a good long time. Ed could not go anywhere without a guard with him. It was a horrible, horrible thing. Suddenly, America's favorite foxy uncle, which, you know, Ed was, Lou Grant was a beloved character. Suddenly, there were certain people who tried to make him into the Red Menace. And I have no doubt that was the reason that the show was canceled. I challenge you to name another series that was ever canceled when it was in the top 10. So the reasons were purely political, and I think it may have been that Mr. Paley at that point just got fed up with the amount of mail that was crossing his desk, or maybe thought that Ed was not being playing things the network way. He was being a bad boy, and therefore they should lop off his head for it. But it was grossly unfair, and Ed had a very difficult time for the next few years after that. And then MTM, of course, had 5 years then of a show which they wanted to sell into syndication. Well, it was impossible. They just couldn't sell the show in the syndication because it had the stigma on it as being this left-wing show. The curious thing is that the character of Lou Grant was a rather right-wing guy. And so the charge that the show had a liberal orientation, you know, could have been true to a certain extent because most of us, you know, to be honest, most of us who were behind the scenes in writing have had sort of a liberal bent. But the curious thing is that our main character was not a liberal. But it remains an enigma. This show that won 26 Emmys, a Peabody Award, I mean, I can't tell you how many Humanitas prizes and things like that, that suddenly, when it was available for syndication, nobody wanted it.
Political attitudes are rampant at most public radio stations. Often people are drawn to work in public radio because they have a chance to speak perhaps out of the mainstream that they can't do in conventional television, radio, and press. So when you sit down to write an episode of FM set at a public radio station, do you fret about these kinds of political issues? Do you want to try and keep them in a light vein? Or are you afraid that there'll be a character who might develop in a Lou Grant, Ed Asner kind of direction?
Well, we're not making an effort to make this a political show by any means. But if politics seems appropriate, we're not going to shy away from it. There is a character on the show who, a Lebanese comedian who does a satire show, which he calls Capital Punishment. You know, we've gone after, you know, I'm not terribly proud of going after Dan Quayle, but we did.
He's a big target.
It seems like an easy target, but I think we did something extremely funny in the Dan Quayle that will be on our third show. So we do those kinds of things, but they are not what the show is about. The show is really about, as the Mary Tyler Moore Show was about, the people who populate this radio station, as the Mary Show was about the people who populated the WJM or the newsroom in WJM. It is really about the way people relate. It's a character comedy. So, you know, if along the way we can make our political points, we'd like to, and because it allows us to be somewhat topical.
My guest is television producer Alan Burns, who has a new show called FM that he's co-produced, co-created, and co-written. It'll be airing this Thursday. There's one aspect of public radio that you noticed about the underwriting credits. And in fact, you deal with the particular jargon of an underwriting credit. And I'd like to hear an example of this scene.
I'm Ted Costas, and this is Long Day's Journey into Lunch, made possible this morning by a grant from Modudyne Microchips. Have you tasted any microchips lately? Well, folks, have you noticed how flavorless they are? Well, I bet you haven't eaten a Modudyne. They're mouth-watering and 100% cholesterol-free, and now available in zesty jalapeno.
You have an ear for detail, the kinds of nuance that goes into the whole setup of the operation of a radio station. Were underwriting credits something that have always stood out for you? The inanity of some of them?
Or yes. Yeah, of course. And when we went to KCRW and talked to Ruth Hirschman, who's the general manager there, she said that's one of the big bugaboos of what she does, is how to write these underwriting credits so they don't come out as commercials for the companies that are the corporations generally that are underwriting. Because they get very close to the line at times. And also, she said, a lot of their copy makes them their own worst enemies. You know, the pedantic quality of some of the writing that comes to them. You almost gag on what you have to read, but it's there.
Your career started out first as an NBC page, and then you went to work for Jay Ward, the creator of Bullwinkle.
Yeah, I did work on that. And that was one of the happier credits in my career, I think. As a matter of fact, you know, my kids get more mileage out of that, or did, than all the other credits combined for which I won all those Emmys. The Bullwinkle and Rocky and His Friends and Dudley Do Right stuff has always gotten... it always gets a wonderful reaction, by the way. We filmed this show in front of an audience. And
you film FM in front of an audience?
Excuse me? FM, yes. And when the man who does the warm-up for the show mentions my credits, they usually yawn. But when you come to Bullwinkle, they all start cheering. So, I mean, there is for a show that wasn't on the air all that long, and it was so long ago now, it was 18, 20 years ago, it sure has maintained a terrifically loyal core of fans.
There was a quality about Bullwinkle. It was so wonderfully bizarre and off the wall. Have you ever had such freedom since? Do you feel that freedom in doing sitcoms now?
Well, you know, Jay Ward, who was the producer of Rocky and His Friends and Bullwinkle, always encouraged us to write to please ourselves, which I think was the greatest lesson I learned. And I've always tried to do that. I mean, to one degree or another, you have pressures that don't permit you to do that as much as you would like. But to not underestimate your audience has always been a very important clue to me. And Jay gave us that freedom and said, I mean, obviously, you know, those of your listeners who watched Bullwinkle or Rocky know that there was a lot of satire in it. And there was a lot of stuff that was just going to go over the kids' heads. And we're a bunch of, you know, 25 to 50-year-old men, I guess, in that case, writing these shows. And you had to do something to keep yourself amused, and that was it.
Animation would
be the part that would keep the kids amused, and there would always be some silly stuff in them. But you did stuff that was... we made each other laugh with it, and that was what was important. And I think that's what we try to do. I've always tried to do in these shows we've done on MTM. And I think we've been successful with that, by and large.
Your show is opening here in the midst of August, and the first five episodes will carry you into September. What are the strengths of opening at this time of year? Will it have momentum to carry you on through? Is it something you...
Sedge, I haven't a clue. I mean, I don't know why we're on this time of year, but we're accepting it. It's sort of a fait accompli. It wouldn't be my choice. Brandon Tartikoff claims that he is trying to prove that there is no season for television. I'm not sure he's right, but he's trying to make a point that you can bring on a show at any time, and if you promote it properly and advertise it properly, it will find its audience. Maybe he's right. I hope so. I mean, this is a lot of work and effort has gone into these shows. I've never had a network guy say this to me. He said, you got to get good reviews on this one. That's news. I mean, usually they don't care about that. In this instance, I think he's under some pressure to put on some better programming, I think. He's gotten criticized lately, I think, for the fact that NBC's sites seem to have been lowered from those days of Hill Street Blues and Cheers when it first started and St. Elsewhere. So I think he's under some pressure to get some good reviews, and he wants this show to get them. But I've never had a network chief tell me that before.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in and talking with us about FM and your work. Thanks very much for coming in on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Sedge.